Training to become a surgeon can feel like training for the Olympics. Then we finish and we realize we're just adults with jobs. Life after training is an entirely different landscape. You need to get to know you. What does success mean for you? What brings you joy? What's your purpose? I'm Dr. Mel Thacker, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and coach. I'm here to help surgeons like you rediscover themselves. Welcome to Surgeons with Purpose. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. So today we're going to talk about emotional adulthood, the emotionally adult surgeon. I love this concept, the concept of emotional childhood and emotional adulthood, because it's so important. I first heard it from a brilliant coach named Brooke Castillo. I highly recommend that you check her out. Check out her podcast, the Life Coach School podcast. She's the founder of that school, and she talks about this in episode 25. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It complements everything I'm discussing. And so it's so important to talk about emotional adulthood and emotional childhood. And I'm smiling and chuckling to myself because I'm remembering all of the emotional children that I encountered through my years of training and through the more than decade that I have been a surgeon. And I have 100% been an emotional child in the operating room. I think a lot of you who are listening have seen tantrums like a complete toddler in the operating room. It's just a rampant problem. We tell ourselves, or we're modeled, that that is how we are supposed to comport ourselves. And so what I want to tell you today is that you don't have to do that. You can actually take good care of patients without being an emotional child. But how do you do that? It's easier said than done. So let me give you some definitions first. Emotional childhood essentially means we do not take responsibility for how we feel, and instead we outsource our emotions by casting blame on others and pointing our finger at the quote unquote villains in our life. Or maybe even pointing our finger at circumstances. And it often leads us to spinning ourselves in the drama triangle, where we create a chronic victimhood for ourselves. And this can last well into our adulthood. This can last until the end of our lives. Like, some people live to be 80s or 90s, and they continue to be emotional children. Like, my grandfather is a great example of that. He was an emotional child all the way up until the day that he died, and his villain of choice was the Rockefeller family because he happened to live in poverty. He and my grandmother came out of the Great Depression, and all of their life circumstances, so they thought, were caused by the Rockefeller family and the government. And so my grandfather blamed other entities, other people, for his negative emotions and for his circumstances and results. And that's basically what emotional childhood is. It's blaming others for our negative emotions, for our circumstances, for our bad behaviors. And it's kind of interesting that my grandfather was very poor and blamed the government, blamed people who had money. But like, if he looked at his life, he and my grandmother made the choice to have 13 children and for only one of them to work a blue-collar job. So come on, I mean, they kind of made their bed, they had to lie in it, but they didn't see the world that way because they weren't seeing it through the eyes of an emotional adult, particularly my grandfather. My grandmother was actually a totally different story. She was an amazing woman, but my grandfather chose to see the world through the lens of an emotional child. And so emotional adulthood means that we take full responsibility for how we think, feel, and act, no matter the circumstances. So you go to the OR and something's on back order, or your equipment isn't working, or you get a tech who has never scrubbed your service before. As an emotional adult, you can accept those circumstances and you can get very curious and creative so that you can find a solution to them. One good example would be recently when the pledgets that I use were on back order. And so I had to kind of hunt down these larger pledgets and cut them up. And it took a little bit of time and effort to kind of do that. And that happened to be the solution. But I could have had a tantrum about it, and maybe an older version of me would have had a little bit of a negative response to it. But I was like, you know what? No problem. We will cut these pledgets. And then the scrub techs, who are just so lovely and wonderful and go the extra mile for me, took the initiative to kind of cut up those pledges the next time I was in the OR. And so it was just like, they were just there. They're like, something's on back order, but we already figured out the solution creatively. So that's what we did. Another example is that I used to use this kind of latex tubing so I could maneuver my suction better. It allowed me to twist my wrist when I was doing sinus surgeries and septoplasties, which is basically the only surgeries I do. And the hospital where I work completely eliminated all latex products. And so I had to find a creative solution to that. So I looked around and I'm like, I need something that's like flexible tubing. And what I ended up doing was borrowing the nasal trumpet from the anesthesiologist. And now I use nasal trumpets and the scrub techs just kind of cut them and I'm able to maneuver my suction tubing. And then another example is when my table and my rooms were set up wrong for a really long time at the hospital where I operate. And I didn't realize the reason behind that was because my card was basically unreadable. I mean, the way that the hospital does the preference cards is like pages and pages of what looks like gibberish. It doesn't make any sense. And so if I had a scrub tech or a nurse who hadn't worked with me and who didn't know ENT, my room would not be set up well. There's a lot of equipment to set up in my room, especially when I use image guidance. I use this thing called Brain Lab, and there's a tower, and it has to be on a specific side of the bed. And then there's all these pedals because I typically use suction Bovie and bipolar cautery, and I have a microdebrider. And so that is a little bit complicated. And then sometimes I turn the bed 180 degrees. And my table is always a little bit complicated too, because I have one Mayo for image guidance, and then I use only specific instruments, and I only use a couple of them. But based on my card, they would pull out like all the ones that I didn't need, and they wouldn't know how to set up any of the image guidance equipment. And so I kept running into these situations, and I was like, oh, I keep delaying my room, because I would basically have to teach the scrub tech and the circulator how to set up my room and my table every single time. And so it was like, I felt like I was reinventing the wheel with every surgery, and it was so energy depleting. And so part of me wanted to be a complete emotional child and complain and throw a fit and be like, how is this okay? But I was able, because I have all of this information and these techniques and these tools and this coaching, right, to kind of get curious instead. And that's when I looked through my card and I was like, this is unreadable. No human being could read this and figure out what I need. And so instead I was like, I'm going to get creative and I know a good solution. I'm going to create a one-page piece of paper that will be a visual for how I need my room set up in each of the different types of surgeries that I do. And since I only do a couple, sinus surgery with image guidance, sinus surgery without image guidance, and it just means the room is flipped because the bed is turned 180 degrees with one and you leave the head at anesthesia with the other. And so I made these two one-page sheets complete with all the drawings and everything labeled, and I drew out what my table looked like, and I drew out all the instruments that I use and what I needed, and I labeled everything, and it was so readable, like a kindergartner could look at that and know how to set up my room and know how to set up my tables. And it just made everything so easy to visualize. And so that was like my creative solution to this systemic problem. It worked. Like ever since then, even if I had people who didn't know me, they would know how to set up my room. And so that's kind of what I'm advocating for, because that's not something we typically learn. We don't get any special emotional adult training. Like nobody took us aside in residency. At least I didn't have anybody take me aside and say, you know, things are going to happen, surprises are going to come up, and this is how you deal with it. This is what it looks like to be an emotional adult. In fact, a lot of what was modeled for us and was modeled for me, not everyone, but in some cases, was emotional childhood. Tantrums, throwing fits, complaining. So we don't get any class in high school or college. We don't get trained in this in residency. And the result is that there are a lot of adult humans in the world who are emotional children. There are a lot of surgeons in the world who function as emotional children. You know, I'm thinking like the times where like a tech doesn't know the instrument, and so the surgeon throws something at them. That's an extreme example. I've seen that happen, or something similar to that. Or a nurse makes a mistake, or a tech makes a mistake, and the surgeon starts yelling and throwing instruments, or equipment doesn't work and they have a tantrum. There's long turnover time, there's SBD delays, always getting angry at anesthesia, right? They're just throwing a complete fit or a tantrum, and it's rampant. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the emotional child, with the surgeon who is stuck in an emotional childhood, because I don't want to blame them either. I get where it comes from, and I was there once too. I was a total emotional child when I didn't have the right equipment, or I didn't have what I needed, or I didn't have working equipment. I would absolutely throw a tantrum. And there was one time where I threw a complete and total fit and had to cancel all of my cases because my towers weren't working well. And this was after I had said several times that it wasn't working well. It was like, I think it was SD and what I needed was HD. Like, I couldn't see well. And so I kind of went off the rails that day. And because of that, they got all new equipment. And so all of our towers are now HD and updated, and they're beautiful. And it's really unfortunate that we're shown that we kind of have to throw a fit, to like throw a tantrum in order to create and affect change, right? But that's what we're kind of shown. That's what's modeled for us because it often works. And that's a problem. There are other ways to effect change, to take care of patients, and to respect and be kind to everyone in the operating room, even leadership, even when leadership drops the ball, okay? There's a way to do it in a way where we show up in the world in a way that we're proud of ourselves. We're not shaming ourselves or feeling guilty because we're like, who the heck was that person? I mean, I remember the day I had that freak out. Everybody's like, oh, Mel's freak out got us all the new equipment. But I felt awful for days after that. I was like, who was that person? Like, that was not me. I felt so much shame and guilt. And how could I have done that? Like, I was acting out of control. I felt out of control. And I was like, how could I have done that? And so that didn't feel good. That felt awful. And so that's kind of the situation we create for ourselves when we act like emotional children. And there's a better way. And I'm going to teach you a better way. And now I do things that way, and it's a lot better. We think everything is happening to us when we're an emotional childhood. That circumstances and that other people are creating our feelings. But it's not true, because as adults, we get to take responsibility. We need to take responsibility for everything that we think, feel, every action that we take, and all of the results in our life. And so this is perpetuated by how we talk to children as well. Our language matters. I mean, how common is it for a teacher or a parent to say like, oh, little Johnny, you hurt Timmy's feelings, right? You need to apologize for hurting Timmy's feelings. Or that hurt mommy's feelings. That's another one. Even when I was in the throes of anxiety and depression around 2021, I remember having some sort of emotional reaction where I was having thoughts in my brain that were creating anxiety for me. And while I was having that anxious moment, like an anxiety attack, I must have been making a face or emoting in some way. And I remember my son saying to my daughter, like, Nora, you're scaring mama. And at that moment in time, I was like, oh my God, I cannot demonstrate to my children, I cannot model to my children that they have the ability to make me feel a certain way. Like, no, Colin, Nora is not scaring mama. Mama can only scare herself with her own thoughts. And so that's kind of like the turning point for me where I was like, oh my gosh, I can't teach my children that they can scare me. I can't teach them that they can do anything to me. I do these things to myself, and I want them to understand that they do these things to themselves as well. Like, no, Colin, you can't hurt Nora's feelings. Nora will hurt her own feelings by how she interprets what you say to her. And this isn't to give anybody like a free pass on being mean or unkind. Not at all. Like, I'm always telling my children, like, kindness, please, right? I'm shutting down unkind words or unnecessary criticisms. And that's completely okay to say it in that way. But it's different than saying like, your words are causing that other person to feel a bad emotion, because that can't happen. That other person can choose to take your words and believe them, and then they can harm themselves. And so that's what I'm trying to teach my kids, is like, you can't hurt another person's feelings. Another person can't hurt your feelings unless you let them. You can only hurt your own feelings. And so it's everywhere we do it automatically. where we send the message that other people and circumstances in the world should be responsible for how we feel. And it's so incredibly disempowering. And just to take it one step further, the more we worry about what someone says to us, like a criticism or an insult, we worry that it could be true, the more we are triggered. So let's take the example of little Johnny and little Timmy. Okay, we have little Johnny, little Timmy, and Johnny says to Timmy, "You're stupid." Now, Timmy is going to be more likely to believe Johnny's assessment of him, Johnny's criticisms, if Timmy is like, "Oh my God, I am stupid." And then Timmy's going to have a negative emotional reaction. Like he's going to feel upset and offended if he worries that what Johnny is saying to him could be true. But the fact of the matter is that Johnny is being unkind. You know, he's saying, "You're stupid." That's not a kind thing to say. And as an adult, I would point that out and shut that down. You know, I would be like, "Listen, we don't say unkind things like that. Johnny, like, get your shit together." Something along those lines. But let's say Timmy feels super secure in his intelligence. Let's say Timmy is like, "I know I'm bright. I get really good grades. I'm a good test taker." So by the traditional sense, there's a lot of evidence to support the fact that I am in fact smart. And I'm also very creative and I push boundaries and I think outside the box and I'm willing to try and fail. I'm willing to take risks and to do something poorly, learn from it and try again. So I have all of these qualities that will actually translate into success for me when I'm an adult. So that signals to me that I am not stupid, in fact. So maybe Timmy feels super secure in himself, his ability to be successful one day. And so when Johnny is like, "You're stupid," if Timmy is feeling super secure in his own self-identity, his self-concept, he's not going to be triggered by Johnny's words. Instead, he's going to be confused. He's going to be like, "That's actually not true. Actually, I am smart. I have all of these external indicators to prove it, and I know it about myself. I know I'm bright," right? And so he's going to be more confused instead of triggered and upset. Johnny said the same thing. He said, "You're stupid." And in one scenario, Timmy has hurt feelings. And in another scenario, Timmy is just feeling confused. So he can either hurt himself, he can choose to believe it and feel upset and offended, or he can choose to believe what he knows to be true about himself. It's someone who has a very strong self-concept, right? It almost insulates you, letting others' words be internalized and then you hurting yourself. And so when someone says something to us and we feel super triggered, like we want to pull an emotional child, we're pulled into that realm of emotional childhood and we want to let it hurt us. We want to let their words sink in and we question, "Oh my gosh, is it true? Like, you're not a very good surgeon. You're not a slick surgeon," or something along those lines. And this might not be even another person saying this to us. This might be our own brain harassing us, right? But if we worry it could be true, then we're going to have the emotional reaction. But if we know it's not true because we have a very strong self-concept or we just know it's just a lie, then we won't have that emotional reaction, that negative emotional reaction. We won't be pulled into that emotional childhood. And so another example would be if someone is 6'7" in height, and let's say I walk up to them and I'm like, "You're so short. You're like a short shorty. How do you even like reach your cabinets at home when you're that short?" And so that person is going to be like, "What are you talking about? Like, I'm way taller than the average human being. Why are you calling me short?" And so that person would feel confused because I'm pointing out something that they know to be untrue. It's like obviously untrue. But we are triggered and more likely to harm ourselves with someone's words or someone's criticism and move into that place of emotional childhood when we worry that what they're saying could be true. We're more apt to let other people's words hurt us if we fear that they could be true for us. But as emotional adults, no one can hurt us without our permission. We only hurt ourselves. And so we have the ability to not hurt ourselves. As an emotional adult, we take responsibility for every emotion we feel, no matter what someone else says or does, no matter our circumstances. And when I say that, I'm telling you that this is not easy. This is not an easy thing to do, to implement. It's simple. The concept of it is simple, but the implementation is not easy. It's very hard. It's very easy to fall into blame and pointing our fingers at people. And so a lot of my clients come to me with a ton of drama from a place of emotional childhood. Like they'll say, my boss sent me this snarky email and now I'm upset. Or this administrator said this thing to me and now I'm so anxious about my job. Or this doctor said I wasn't doing enough when I went above and beyond. And now I feel like I'm being completely misunderstood and they don't get it. Or even the drama from training, like an attending or resident bullied me. The classic drama triangle stuff. And if you haven't listened to the drama triangle episode, I highly recommend you go back and listen to it. I talk about all of this. But essentially, a client comes to me and they're like, I'm a victim. And this other person or this other program, this program or this thing is the villain in my life. And so then the question becomes, of all the people in the world, of all the entities in the world, you're going to allow them or that to occupy your headspace. You're going to give your power to that person or to that entity. You're giving it to that bully from residency. You're giving your power to that administrator. You're giving your power to your boss. Like you're really going to give them power over your emotional life. You're going to outsource your emotions to that person. The truth is you are an adult human and the villains in everybody's story are also adult humans, and every adult human is responsible for how they think, feel, and act. And so the bullying that a client of mine endures in residency is not theirs to own. The bully's the responsible one. Like it is the bully's responsibility for their behavior, not my client. And so it's like, stop giving your power away. Like that bully was acting from a place of their thoughts and feelings, probably based on how they were treated as a resident. And so they were perpetuating a vicious cycle and it has nothing to do with you. So it's like, don't disempower yourself and allow your emotional life to be in the hands of someone else. Don't allow yourself to indulge in negative emotions because of someone else's choices and how they behave, how they show up in the world. And so notice that when you blame the villain for how you feel, it typically fuels an action in you that you don't want to take. It'll fuel an action, for example, like complaining. Complaining is kind of the adult version of throwing a tantrum. And so sometimes adults just throw an outright tantrum, right? We've all seen that in the OR. As I said, I'm guilty of it. And that's emotional childhood in the OR at its best. And that is a place where we have no control. Okay, when we're in emotional childhood brain, when we're throwing a tantrum, when we're screaming and yelling, and we're just completely off the rails, we have lost control. We've relinquished the control of our body and our actions and our words, and it's a really bad thing to do. It's not useful for anyone. It doesn't help. It doesn't effect any sort of beneficial change in the situation. But the problem is that a lot of times it does create change in that people start to walk on eggshells around surgeons who lash out as emotional children, or the support team starts to do everything they can to make sure everything is as perfect as it can be so that they don't get yelled at. So in the brain of the emotional child surgeon, they're like, yeah, this works great for me, especially if they're like narcissists and don't care how they make others feel. But if you're sensitive like I am, it became a very big problem for me because I was like, that is not who I want to be. That's not how I want to show up in the world. And like, to what end? Think of all the people that they're hurting and we think we have to act that way, but we don't. And then there's also this concept of infantile omnipotence. And this concept is kind of a form of magical thinking that we have some sort of control over the world. It comes from infancy because when we were babies, we would just poop ourselves or we would be hungry and we would cry. And then magically a caretaker, an adult human would appear and they would clean us up and give us a fresh diaper or they would feed us. So it kind of perpetuates this false notion that we can somehow pull the levers of the world, like I cry and then I get cleaned up, or I cry and then I get fed. And now I'm not feeling those hunger pains. And now I'm not feeling the like poop in my diaper. And so kids are completely physically and emotionally dependent on adults. So when their needs are not being met, they let everyone know. They act out. But that is because they are dependent, okay? They don't have the ability or the capacity to act as an emotional adult, to take responsibility for everything they do, for meeting their own needs. Emotional adults, on the other hand, meet their own needs. Emotional children do not. They're dependents. And so what I'm inviting you to do, I'm inviting all of us to do, is to move out of that dependency and to move into an independency with an interdependency. And so it's like, going from a dependent, a child, to an independent adult who is also interdependent. And I say interdependent because we're social creatures. We are not isolated hermits. We require the support of each other. We have to lean on each other. And so if I go back to that moment that I told you about when my son was like, "Nora, you're scaring mama," I was having thoughts in my head that were creating anxiety for me. And I was exhibiting that so that my kids could see. But if I could go back in time, I would have said, "Hey, Colin, like, and Nora, come over here. Like, Nora, you're not scaring mama. Mama is scaring herself with her own thoughts and feelings. And I'm going to reach out for help because I need help in this moment." And so that would be me being both independent and interdependent, like modeling independence and interdependence for my children, where I'm telling them, "You're not the one who's causing me this emotion. I'm the one who's creating it for myself. And I need some help and I'm going to go seek it because I can't always manage my emotions on my own." And so that is where we need to be, honestly, as adults. We need to get to a place of independence and interdependence and away from a place of dependence. That's basically emotional adulthood. And so with infantile omnipotence, it's like it makes sense that an adult surgeon who is functioning as an emotional child would see the value in throwing a tantrum, right? Because they saw the value of being loud and crying when they were a baby. That's how they got their parents' attention. And so that's how I'm going to get the OR leadership's attention right now, right? They're just swapping out their parents when they were babies for like the techs and the nurses and the anesthesia team and the leadership in the OR. Those are now the players in their world and they're trying to influence them with their tantrum. And so crying in infancy becomes complaining and yelling and bullying in adulthood. And so that is the lever that they're pulling now. They were like, "When I was a baby, I cried and that created change. I got cleaned up and fed. And now as an adult, I'll throw a big tantrum and everybody starts like moving faster and I get things done. Things start working for me and I have less hiccups in the operating room. And so I'm going to do that." It's like the same lever being pulled to create a result that the surgeon who is an emotional child wants. And then everyone just starts to fear that surgeon. It's like walking on eggshells around them. And so people who work with that surgeon do the best they can to kind of anticipate what they need and to get ready for it just to avoid the discomfort of being yelled at or experiencing the rage of an emotional child. And the surgeon, meanwhile, is justifying their reaction. They're going to tell themselves a story that it's totally justifiable to act that way because it's surgery, because people's lives are on the line. And so they're like, "The stakes are high. I get to be an emotional child." It's almost like we think they go hand in hand. And that's wild to me. So what I'm saying is that we can show up to the OR as an emotional adult and not lash out at people and take good care of patients. We can take good care of our staff, treat them with respect and kindness, take good care of ourselves, treat ourselves with respect and kindness, and take good care of patients, and accept circumstances without resistance. Get creative and curious when things come up, how to fix the problem, how to troubleshoot the problem, all while taking really, really good care of patients. And so that is where we need to be in order to function as an emotional adult in surgery. And it's a complete fallacy that we have to be an emotional child in order to take good care of people. But it requires us to take full responsibility of how we think, feel, and act. And I want to also say that being an emotional adult doesn't mean you don't apologize or that you don't take responsibility for how you treat others. Just because you know you can't make them feel any certain way or hurt their feelings, that you're just going to say whatever you want. That's not what I'm saying. You are still responsible for the actions you take, for the words that come out of your mouth, for how you behave and how you show up in the world. And in fact, emotional adults are typically more willing to apologize than emotional children. But because emotional adults are intentional and thoughtful about how they show up in the world, they are way less likely to act out. We are humans, though, and when we are tired and spread thin and burnt out, we can easily slip into emotional childhood, and that's okay. When we are restored and resourced, we can become an emotional adult again and start to take responsibility for our words and our actions when we were in child mode. So I'd love you to all explore where this is happening in your life. Like, where in your life or in the OR or the clinic are you blaming others? Where are you failing to take responsibility? Where are you feeling entitled to having something? That feeling of like entitlement is a huge one for my clients. And it was a huge one for me. Like, I did all this work. I put in all this time, energy, and effort, and money. I should be happy. I have power, status, and wealth, so I should feel good. Like, I'm entitled to feel good. But the way the world works is nothing outside of us can make us happy. Our feelings, results are all our responsibility and our responsibility alone. And so I encourage you to start to look around your world and see where you have these issues. See when you're an emotional child versus when you're an emotional adult, and remind yourself that you are responsible for how you think, what you feel, and how you act, and all of your results in your life. I would love to hear from you. Please email me at mel@melthackercoaching.com with any insights or ahas or any questions. I would love to engage with you. I love hearing from you all. And I hope you have a great week. I will see you all next week. Hey, when you got into surgery, when you were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you told yourself a story that it was going to be amazing, and it's not. That's okay. If you want to learn how to navigate the landscape of life after training, you are in luck. I have created a course just for you. It's called Empowered Surgeons Curriculum. It gives you everything you need to learn that you didn't learn in training about how to be a human in the world of surgery. All you have to do is go to courses.melthackercoaching.com/courses/empowered surgeon or click the link in the show notes. See you inside the course.